ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, bushfires threaten homes in WA's southwest, and it's feared some have already been lost. Also, in the aftermath of the Tasmanian election, the Liberal Party's negotiating with the Jackie Lambie Network as it seeks to form a minority government. And will the horrific terrorist attack in Moscow affect Vladimir Putin's leadership?
This terrorist attack shows that actually behind that power is actually a relatively weak and dysfunctional government. They couldn't react quickly to this event. I think it's one of Putin's worst nightmares for something like this to happen because it makes him look weak.
First tonight, it's believed homes have been lost as a bushfire burns out of control in Western Australia's southwest. The blaze started in a forest on Saturday and has so far burnt through about 3,000 hectares of bush and farmland. The emergency comes after a challenging summer for the state's firefighters, who say they're still facing worse than expected conditions. This report from Isabel Massali.
As the bushfire emergency stretches into a third day, stories of near misses are emerging.
He came into our house, looked at me in the eye and said, "You have 3 minutes. You have 3 minutes."
Kingsley Dixon was given the stark warning by firefighters battling a blaze about 100 kilometres south of Perth. While his home was saved, everything else on his property was lost, including his well-known botanic garden, a passion project for the internationally recognised Professor of Botany.
And I looked across, you know, through all of our tree ferns and our fountains, and they were still running, and all I could see was the first spotting fires. And then I thought I was listening to easterly wind. It wasn't. And then it rolled into us. We got out with about a minute to spare, and watched our beautiful tea house. As we drove by, we saw the wall on fire, and that would have gone first, but we got out.
It was a similar story for former Olympic pole vaulter Emma George, who found out this morning both her home and her father's were spared. She's thanked the community for ensuring he was evacuated.
When the fire got really close, the neighbour and the fire just came and actually forced him out, said, "You are leaving. If you stay, you may die." You just, you know, you blink and you think how things can change in 1 week. But the most thing I'm grateful for is that the fireys, the neighbours, got my dad out and that there's been no loss of life, because you can replace buildings, you can replace all of that, but you can't replace life.
WA's fire authorities say the fire was not deliberately lit. So far, it's burnt through 3,000 hectares of bush and farmland and destroyed property. It's put lives and homes at risk in an area between Waroona and Pinjarra. Premier Roger Cook says an evacuation centre has been set up nearby.
Hundreds of firefighters are working to battle this blaze in extremely challenging conditions. We're extremely proud of our volunteer and career firefighters who have done an outstanding job. This is an incredibly difficult time for the Waroona community, and again, I'd like to thank everyone who has worked to keep the community safe. Our hearts go out to that community, and we want people to remain vigilant and to follow the advice on Emergency WA and to keep safe. And our thoughts are with you.
Homes in other parts of the state have been destroyed by fire in recent months. And with low rainfall over summer and dry soil, authorities fear there could be more dangerous fires to come this autumn. Andrew Wright is the South West Superintendent for the Department of Fire and Emergency Services.
We have heard from the Bureau that obviously April will be predominantly dry. There's no forecast rains in sight just yet. Any of these sort of conditions that we've seen over the last few weeks, combined with wind and even just a nice average day, are going to support some pretty ordinary fire behaviour. What we saw over Saturday, Sunday was well in excess of what we were able to predict.
Residents in fire danger areas are advised to check their state's emergency services website and listen to ABC local radio for updates.
Isabel Massali reporting. The Tasmanian Liberal Party will be forced to rely on support from inexperienced MPs elected under the Jackie Lambie Network banner in order to form a new government after the weekend's election. As negotiations begin in earnest, the outspoken Tasmanian senator is declaring her MP's support will come with several conditions. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Australia's only remaining Liberal government appears set to hold on to power in Tasmania, having won more seats than the Labor opposition, but not enough to govern alone. It's the new MPs from the Jackie Lambie network who have emerged as kingmakers on a significantly expanded crossbench that will also include at least four Greens MPs and two independents. After criticising the Liberals' conduct in recent weeks, Senator Lambie is now ready to make peace.
You know, everybody deserves a second and third chance, and what we want is stability in Tasmania. And I think you'll find that they're happy to form government, but that won't give them a guarantee that we will be voting on every piece of legislation with them. But we do want supply. We do want to make sure that supply continues.
She's had discussions with Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockliff, and more meetings are expected to happen over Easter. While her candidates aren't after ministries, they may have some demands.
I think we've made it very clear, and we sold, you know, we sold on integrity and transparency. We want to see a lot more of that coming out. And they could come up and just say, look, you know, we want an independent review on actually what do the books look like in Tasmania so we know what we're up against.
It also puts the future of a promised AFL stadium in Hobart under a cloud.
You know, I think my people are frothing at the mouth to go and have a look at that contract and see what that looks like, see whether we've been sewn in, see if we withdraw out of that, do we have to pay the AFL? Fill out anything? How tight is that contract? And once again, is there a better way of doing this where it is less spend?
Vote counting won't be finalised for more than a week. So while it's likely up to three Jackie Lambie Network candidates will be elected, exactly who they are isn't clear yet. Whoever it is, Tasmania's Deputy Premier Michael Ferguson is promising the Liberals can make it work.
The people of Tasmania have spoken. We've got to listen to them, honour their vote, and then act honourably and with stability in the parliament itself.
Former MP Lara Alexander was one of two Liberals who quit the party to sit on the crossbench last year. She's now lost her seat and isn't as optimistic about Premier Jeremy Rockliff's negotiation skills.
If he was unable to work in a consultative and collaborative way with John and I, how is he going to be working with other people, as you pointed out, who sit more on a complete opposite view of the Liberal Party?
It'll be challenging because the situation is more difficult than the one they were previously in, and they were unable to negotiate stable government before.
Associate Professor Kate Crowley from the University of Tasmania points out there are some key issues on which the Jackie Lambie network will want action, some of them at odds with Liberal Party policies.
They don't want to see money wasted on a stadium, and that they want salmon farming looked at. They want old growth logging not expanded, and they want youth offenders out of custody. So even though they don't have policies, they have some things that they want done.
But are there question marks too over these potential MPs? I guess we don't really know a lot about them. We don't know how well they've been vetted by the party. We don't know if they'll all agree with each other.
Yes, it's an interesting experiment because it's a network, right? Really, rather than a party, it's a network. And Jackie Lambie herself has been very upfront in saying that her MPs will make their own decisions. Whether they make them as individuals or make them together, I imagine it would be together, but she's not going to be guiding their decision-making, but she will be providing mentoring.
As for the Labor opposition, after again failing to make inroads in improving their share of the vote, the leadership will be spilled. Current leader Rebecca White is considering her position. Already at least one other contender has come forward, the party's energy spokesman Dean Winter.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting from Hobart. Four men charged with carrying out the terror attack in Moscow over the weekend have now appeared in court. All are reportedly from Tajikistan. More than 130 people were killed in the attack on a concert hall. American authorities had warned in early March that extremists were planning to target big gatherings in Moscow, and it appears they were right, with an affiliate of Islamic State known as ISIS-K claiming responsibility for the atrocity. But Kremlin officials and Russian state media are pushing the line Ukraine was responsible. So just a couple of weeks after the Russian President Vladimir Putin secured another six-year term in a rigged election, will the terror attack have any effect on his leadership? Will Partlett is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne's Law School and has a particular interest in Russian politics and society. Professor Partlett, what do you think went through Vladimir Putin's mind when he heard a terror attack had been carried out just as the US had warned?
Well, this is one of the, you know, the big fears of Putin and the people around him, because, you know, that they will appear weak. The election was a demonstration of power, and this terrorist attack shows that actually behind that power is actually a relatively weak and dysfunctional government, the one that it couldn't react quickly to this event. They were warned about this terrorist attack by the United States. And really kind of dismissed it. So it makes, I think it's one of Putin's worst nightmares that for something like this to happen, because it makes him look weak and it exposes the dysfunctionality at the center of the regime.
Why do you think the warnings were dismissed by the Kremlin?
Look, I think there's increasingly a kind of conspiratorial and kind of paranoid mindset that's driving a lot of the decision making at the very tops of Russian government, and I think that therefore. Or they filter any advice or kind of counsel from the Americans and through that, and I think they just thought on this regard that the Americans were trying to use some sort of, this was a game or some way to kind of discredit Russia or whatever. So I think they just dismissed it, and I think that was what drove it.
So the Kremlin's now pushing the line that Ukraine was behind the attack. How difficult will it be for Russians to get any objective information on this, and in fact the information that ISIS-K has claimed responsibility?
Well, it's interesting where you look on Russian media. I mean, some Russian media is actually reporting on the facts and actually suggesting, talking about the videos where it was very clear that they were using calls for, you know, Islamic violence and so forth. In some areas, I think there is a discussion of that, but there's always this insinuation in the Russian media that maybe somehow the Ukrainians were involved and so forth. So, you know, I think that kind of line is being continually used, and we'll see how effective it is, but it certainly is an attempt to try to deflect some of the real accountability that should really lie in the Kremlin here and being unable to protect the security of its citizens.
Are there any Russian strongmen, is the word often used to describe them, any rivals to Putin who may use this to try and destabilize him?
No, there's none at the moment. Putin has done a very good job of making sure that he is the only one in charge, and that any potential opposition, democratic or otherwise, has been either killed or just pushed to the side or exiled. So we don't see any at the moment. Now, that doesn't mean that one won't emerge. And I do think, at the moment, obviously, Putin can kind of maybe keep a lid on things for a while. But when he does eventually leave office, this dysfunctionality is probably only going to get worse. And then we might see the rise of kind of rival strongmen trying to take over the office of the president and a real struggle for power.
Do you think it's likely Russia will increase its attacks on Ukraine pretty soon to push that idea that country was responsible for the terror attack?
Yes, I think we absolutely are going to see attempts to distract from the mourning and all of the focus on this by showing that the system is showing how strong the system is by making performances of attempts at really hitting the Ukrainians hard and trying to, I think, also take advantage of this window they have now where the Ukrainians are actually short on ammunition. And are on the back foot on many of the front lines at the moment. So I do think we're going to see an intensification by the Russians at the front lines in response to this and other factors.
Russia, though, is presumably now going to have to keep a closer eye on the terror threat. Will it be able to divert resources to that effort, or is it going to take resources and attention away from the war it's waging in Ukraine?
It will. Look, there will be attempts to try to really shore up some of the obviously lapses that took place in allowing this attack to take place, not only to be able to take place, but for these individuals to actually be able to escape, suggested how much they really let this go. So I think they'll try. But the problem is there's a big systemic issues. The systemic issues are that the Russian security services have never been particularly good at this type of counterterrorism operations because they're really focused on other things, particularly, you know, protecting the sovereign power of the president and so forth. So, look, I think there'll be attempts. How effective they're going to be is really just going to have to wait and see.
Will Partlett is an associate professor at the University of Melbourne's Law School. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, should the states abolish stamp duty to help more Australians buy a home? Business groups are warning that more workers will be sacked if the growth in their pay keeps up with or beats inflation, which currently sits just above 4%. They say employers can't afford to pay the higher wages. Their call comes after the federal government announced it'll make a submission to the industrial relations umpire, the Fair Work Commission, seeking minimum and award wage increases that do keep pace with inflation. But economists are concerned higher wages growth could push inflation higher and interest rates higher too. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Each year, the Fair Work Commission decides whether or not to increase the minimum wage, and everyone from business to unions and government put in their 2 cents worth. The federal government, without nominating a specific figure, will this year push for increases that keep pace with inflation. That's on top of, says Treasurer Jim Chalmers, the economic stimulus also set to kick in on July 1 in the form of Stage 3 tax cuts.
Well, we don't see cost of living relief as instead of decent wages growth. We want to see decent wages growth on top of the billions of dollars in cost of living relief that the Albanese government is rolling out.
The minimum wage is currently $23.23 per hour after it increased by 5.75% in July last year to keep pace with high inflation. But inflation has since fallen to 4.1%, and the Reserve Bank has expressed concerns that without higher productivity or workers producing more, wage growth needs to slide. The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, or ACCI, represents businesses big and small across the economy. CEO Andrew McKellar will ask Fair Work that workers covered by the decision get no more than a 2% increase to their pay, which is about half the pace of inflation.
There's no doubt that hiring decisions are starting to slow down. It's going beyond simply reducing the number of hours worked. If we make it too expensive to engage labour, then the risk is that we will see employment starting to come off further in the months ahead.
John Buchanan is an industrial relations expert with the University of Sydney. He says there is no evidence that boosting the pay for those on the bottom wage rungs leads to job losses.
Modest wage increases introduced in a situation of growth is sustainable. The trick is to figure out what's sustainable modest wage growth.
And I also guess that's the point, though, because we don't have anything like normal or average growth at the moment. The economy is growing subpar.
Yeah, but equally, the economy's not falling apart. I mean, you look at the latest employment numbers, they're very, very impressive. But equally, let's not forget, you've got 10% of the workforce either unemployed or underemployed. So there's still, despite all the talk of, you know, the economy hitting capacity constraints, there's still an awful lot of people out there who are not fully employed, and there is the capacity for the economy to draw that labour in and not have it boost inflation.
The Reserve Bank has also repeatedly warned of the risks of a wage price spiral if requests for higher pay go beyond rates of inflation. But economist Leonore Reese says there is no direct link between stronger rates of pay and higher levels of inflation.
The analysis is showing us that there is not a direct link between wage growth and inflation. Inflation is being driven by other factors, including supply side cost, including supply constraints.
However, the RBA warns productivity, or the way Australians work, will need to improve quite a bit to ensure higher rates of pay don't lead to inflation. If that sounds like too much hard work, Leonore Rees says the best way to boost pay is to, you guessed it, bring inflation back down.
The moment where we're going to see wage growth come through the economy is when inflation starts to subside, because the way that workers will experience higher purchasing power is when their real wage improves.
Fair Work will announce its decision on any increase to the minimum wage towards the middle of the year.
David Taylor reporting. As politicians around Australia try to find ways to make it easier for people to buy a home, one of the ideas that often comes up is the possibility of phasing out stamp duty on properties. Stamp duty is a tax collected by state or territory governments on the purchase of a property. The Victorian government is the latest to float getting rid of it and replace the expensive one-off payment with an annual land tax. Oliver Gordon has more.
Father of two, Anthony, is renting, and he wants to buy a first home big enough for his young family. First home buyers are eligible for a discount on stamp duty, but if you're buying a house in Melbourne, you're probably still going to be paying part of it. Anthony says that extra upfront cost is more than he can come up with.
You're putting yourself in a situation where trying to provide for kids, trying to provide for yourself, potentially trying to put yourself through education and being asked to put aside huge amounts of money that when you're in a family, when you start a family at an age like this, you just can't do.
Melbourne's median house price is about $911,000. Someone buying a house that price would pay close to $50,000 stamp duty.
It's definitely a huge component in the purchasing decision, and the fact that it's got to effectively be paid up front, there's no financing options on it, makes it even more difficult, I think, for people who are getting into purchasing a home.
A recent Victorian inquiry into stamp duty found the one-off tax distorts behaviour in the housing market, discouraging people from moving house or downsizing and disadvantaging first home buyers. It recommended the state government look into abolishing the tax and replacing it with a yearly land tax. Now the state's treasurer, Tim Pallas, has responded, saying that he accepts the recommendations in principle. But it's one thing to endorse something and another altogether to implement it.
Stamp duty is currently accounting for about a third of all the Victorian government's own state taxes, about $8 billion a year.
Brendan Coates from the Grattan Institute knows why most Australian governments haven't made the switch yet.
The reason why we haven't shifted away from it is we have to replace it with something else if we want, you know, the schools to stay open and the hospitals to keep running. And so far, only the ACT has been able to square that circle. They're halfway through transitioning away from stamp duty towards a broad-based land tax. The attempts in New South Wales so far have failed recently, but hopefully we'll get some better news for Victoria soon.
So what would a stamp duty-free world look like? Brendan Coates again.
So that means it's probably a tax that's got to be in the realm of $1,000 to $2,000 a year in a city like Sydney or Melbourne, and less, obviously, in some of the other states and territories.
The ACT is the only state or territory to have started making the transition away from stamp duty to an ongoing yearly tax, but the project isn't yet completed. The idea was also floated by former New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet before last year's election, but was not endorsed by then opposition leader and now Premier Chris Minns. While welcomed by most economists, the idea has proven difficult to get over the line politically, with ideas around a never-ending tax on the family home particularly difficult to overcome for whichever government proposing the reform. Real Estate Institute of Victoria President Jacob Cain says it's time for a bipartisan approach.
I'd sort of say to both aisles of power, political parties in this state, the economic and social imperative for removing this wildly ineffective tax are clear. If you do this, if you have the courage to do this, the outcomes will be great for all Victorians, not just a few.
He's joined calls for the Victorian government to scrap stamp duty now.
It will impede or prevent 100,000 families, couples and individuals from moving into appropriate housing, and all that adds up to is a system and taxation instrument that isn't delivering the kind of solutions and results that we need, particularly given we're in the midst of one of the most acute housing supply and affordability crises this state's ever experienced.
Jacob Kane is the president of the Real Estate Institute of Victoria. That report from Oliver Gordon. Menopause. Half the population goes through it, and it can have serious consequences for the health and finances of those women and the broader economy. The number of menopausal women in the workforce is increasing, and their advocates are warning some careers are being cut short by a lack of support for those struggling with symptoms. This report from Alison Shaw.
Thea O'Connor was entering what should have been her power decade at work when she started to experience a kind of fogginess in her brain.
At the age of about 53, 54, I started to experience some changes in my brain that I did not know at the time was due to perimenopause. And that involved things like increase in forgetfulness, less able to concentrate, word finding was a real challenge in the midst of conversations, and it was very destabilising, and it definitely had me questioning my ability to keep running and growing my business.
Thea O'Connor works as a workplace wellbeing advisor and says her experience is common among women experiencing perimenopause, which is the body's transition to menopause. She warns that menopause may be pushing women to leave the workforce early or not seek promotions, cutting their careers short.
But I do see women who haven't applied for that promotion that they normally would have, and that they have all the experience and qualifications to do so because their professional confidence has taken a hit. And for a very small percentage, but a significant percent, the research suggests about 10%, they do quit work because of the symptoms. They feel they just can't keep working.
Menopause happens when a woman hasn't had a menstrual period for 12 months, usually between the ages of 45 and 60. An upcoming Senate inquiry will examine its impacts on women's careers, mental health and early retirement. Thea O'Connor hopes the inquiry will help tackle the fear of discrimination many women feel, which she says is a significant barrier to women speaking up about menopause in the workplace.
I'm really hoping that we do see a campaign that really helps to destigmatise and also promote the upsides of menopause, because gendered ageism definitely feeds into the fears that women experience.
Sydney Calusi is a PhD candidate at the University of Sydney who studied the effect of menopause in the workplace. She says there's a range of policies workplaces could adopt to help retain older working women.
The type of policy that we think is most promising is one that is capable of offering ideally paid leave if needed, as well as accommodating reasonable requests for unpaid leave. But also different, experimenting with different types of flexible working arrangements, and also educational resources for management so that there's just a general awareness and acknowledgement of this issue.
But not all agree. Susan Davis is the director of the Women's Health Research Program at Monash University.
The available evidence is that women do not specifically leave the workforce because they enter perimenopause. We have to understand all the factors that affect women at midlife, like health care responsibilities, social instability, financial issues, and so forth, that impact them in terms of their physical and mental health. So attributing menopause as a reason why women either have difficulties in the workplace, are stressed in the workplace, or leave work is dangerous at the moment because we don't have enough data one way or the other.
She hopes the inquiry will focus on tackling the health outcomes for women at midlife.
The most important thing is that we have the capacity for all women at menopause to have a full health review. So while most women won't have severe symptoms, all women are at risk of changes in their health with weight gain, bone loss, blood pressure changes, cardiovascular risk change.
Thea O'Connor is also concerned about how paid menopause leave would distract from more effective solutions employers could adopt.
If a woman is that debilitated by menopause that she can't work, that represents a failure of the healthcare system. And that's where the responsibility needs to go back to, rather than shift that responsibility and cost onto workplaces. I think the first most important thing is changing the culture and helping to normalise the conversation.
Greens Senator Larissa Waters moved to establish the Senate inquiry last year and is part of the committee that will make recommendations.
I've got an open mind about what that sort of decent treatment of workers would look like. It will change depending on the workplace, but I'm really eager to hear from unions, from workers, from employers, what's reasonable and what can we better do to make sure that women aren't having these symptoms, suffering in silence, and then retiring a lot earlier than they want to.
Senator Waters says the committee is due to hold in-person hearings from June onwards before handing down a report later this year.
Alison Chow reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's not the first time terrorists have attacked a concert, and it happened again on Moscow's outskirts on Friday night as hundreds of people gathered for a sold-out rock gig. So what do we know of the Islamic State group that's claimed responsibility? And could the major security lapse see more Russians doubt Vladimir Putin's leadership? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.